Welcome to the Nutrition Science Podcast, where we help you cut through the noise and make informed, science-based decisions about nutrition and your health.
Before we get into the show, I wanted to let you know that there was some audio issues on my end, and you'll hear as you listen that my audio sounds a bit choppy. So I just wanted to let you know so you didn't think it was your speakers or your headphones. This is a really informative episode. If you can bear with us through the audio issues, I just wanted to let you know that before we got started.
Welcome back to the Nutrition Science Podcast. I have a really special guest today, Dr. David Stukas. We're going to be talking about food allergies, food intolerances, food sensitivities, and everything related to that. Dr. Stukas is the director of the Food Allergy Treatment Center at Nationwide Children's Hospital. He is also the professor of clinical and pediatrics in the Division of Allergy and Immunology at Nationwide Children's as well. In addition to providing clinical care for children with all types of food allergy, Dr. Stukas participates in clinical research, quality improvement, patient advocacy, and medical education. So he's a world-renowned speaker. He holds leadership positions in several academic institutions. He also runs a podcast called The Conversations from the World of Allergy, which I highly recommend checking out if you find this information in this episode helpful. And then you can also find him active on social media. He has a popular Twitter account and an Instagram account as well called Allergy Kids Doc. I highly recommend giving that a follow as well. And he helps to combat information and dispel myths around this topic. And he's also written a textbook on this topic called Social Media for Medical Professionals, which I'm just blown away by the amount of contribution you've made to this space, Dr. Stukas. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you very much for having me. That was a very kind introduction. I'm going to re-listen to that whenever I'm having an off day. That was very nice of you. Thanks.
Yeah. So let's go ahead and jump into the discussion and start off by defining the differences between food allergy, food intolerance, and food sensitivity. So what are those and what are the differences between those?
Yeah, this is extremely important. And this is something I say to every single family that I meet as sort of a new consultation, because until we clarify the diagnosis, the rest of it doesn't matter. So when it comes to most forms of food allergy, it's caused by this IgE antibody. So it causes immediate reactions, typically within minutes, rarely longer than, 1 or 2 hours after eating a food. You typically have to eat the food to cause reactions. And you can have any combination of red itchy hives on the skin, swelling, you can have vomiting, you can have coughing and wheezing, or you can have a systemic reaction called anaphylaxis, which is really more than one organ system being involved. Mm-hmm. If you are eating a food and you're not experiencing those symptoms and you eat a food, you do not have a food allergy. There are other types of delayed onset food allergies, which are much more rare, especially in older children and adults. We can see some forms in infants. There's a common form called milk protein-induced allergic proctocolitis, which is a mouthful, which is a very benign condition, which is basically they get some blood in their stool at an early age when they're drinking cow's milk formula. Sometimes it's transmitted through the breast milk. This almost always resolves by year of age. All right, so that's allergy. Immune response, reproducible. Eat it, I have these symptoms. If I don't eat it, the symptoms should go away. If I have symptoms without eating it, we start to think about other things. Intolerances do not involve the immune system. This is difficulty with digestion. The most common example is lactose intolerance. Lactose is a simple sugar found in dairy products. People with lactose intolerance either temporarily or long-term lack the enzymes necessary to digest this. You eat lactose, it passes through your gastrointestinal tract undigested, and it causes bad problems, such as water being sucked into the bowel or increased gas production. So you have delayed onset hours or later that day or the next day, bloating, cramping, diarrhea, constipation, things like that. So these are mostly GI symptoms. And then lastly, we have food sensitivities, which, just like you, I've spent a lot of time, really investigating from an evidence-based standpoint, everything that I try to talk about and understand the world that we live in. I, for the life of me, and correct me if I'm wrong, cannot find a consensus medical definition for what constitutes a food sensitivity, meaning there is no diagnostic test, which we'll talk about. There are no clearly defined criteria that anybody has to meet in order to be diagnosed with a food sensitivity. But if you spend more than 30 seconds online, you will see everybody yelling at you that you have hidden food sensitivities because they attribute any symptom known to mankind as being a quote unquote food sensitivity. So that's a real problem. So there's really no consensus medical definition. If we really want to get into the weeds, which I'm sure we will, food sensitivities would be more non-immunologic adverse effects from eating a food. But again, it has to be cause and effect. So I'll pause there. I threw a lot at you, but yeah, that's a great place to start.
Yeah, great breakdown of those topics. And as you mentioned, food sensitivity, it really is a general term that is used to label any type of adverse reaction to foods. And there are various types of adverse reactions to foods that can occur, but they don't necessarily, they're not going to fall under this general label as everything is a food sensitivity and people have hidden food sensitivities. That is often more used as a marketing tool to promote some things that we will discuss in this episode a little bit further. So I want to back up and discuss, how do we test for these? So if you think that you have a food allergy or a food intolerance, how can you test for that?
Paying attention to the symptoms that you have and attributing them to the foods that you eat. So having a careful clinical history is always the most important part of testing, evaluation, and establishing the diagnosis. I'll repeat what I said earlier because it's really important. If you're eating a food and you're not having, you know, clearly identifiable symptoms every time you eat it, it's very unlikely that you have an allergy or an intolerance. There's no hidden allergies, intolerances, or sensitivities. So pay attention to your own body. If you're having a lot of vague symptoms and you can't really figure out which food is causing it, it's also unlikely that specific foods are causing those symptoms. When we do have a clinical history that suggests food allergy, every time I eat this, within minutes, I develop hives, swelling, vomiting, anaphylaxis, we have readily available allergy tests. We have skin tests, we have blood tests, and we have oral food challenges. The skin tests apply drops of liquid allergen to the skin, usually on the back or the forearm, gentle little scratch through the top layer of the skin to introduce that allergen to those allergy cells. If that person makes that IgE antibody against the allergen, it opens up the allergy cells to release histamine. Histamine is a chemical that causes a lot of the symptoms and allergic reactions. It takes 15 minutes in the office. The size of the bump or the hive that occurs based upon that indicates the likelihood that that person is allergic. Blood testing measures levels of these specific IgE to a bunch of different foods. The levels come back from a scale of 0.1 to 100. The higher the level indicates the likelihood of somebody being allergic. Neither skin or blood tests are good screening tests because we get tons of false positive results. These aren't pregnancy tests. It's not like a yes-no answer, and they also don't indicate the severity of the reaction. So they're merely a guide towards whether somebody has an allergy, which we should really be diagnosing before we do the test anyways because they have a good history for it. And then the gold standard test is what happens when you eat it. So at our food allergy center, we do about 1,000 oral food challenges a year, which is the best way. Come hang out with us for a few hours. It's very safe. It's very informative. For somebody with a known food allergy, we think they're outgrowing it as they get older. Or if we're trying to clarify the diagnosis at the time of consultation, eat the food in front of us in a very safe way. We give very small amounts. We gradually increase it every 10 minutes or so until they eat a full serving size. If symptoms don't occur, you're not allergic to that food. So that's really the best way to clarify.
Great, great. So you mentioned getting a skin prick test and then also the IgE test. And you mentioned that these are not, you know, these aren't telling you that you do or don't have an allergy. So one of the things that I see quite often, and one of the things that I run into where people are restricting foods, is they've done screening tests, skin prick screening test and IgE screening test. And I've seen you talk about that before. Can you go into a little bit more detail about why that's not recommended?
Yeah, these were never designed to be screening tests. So if you look at all of the criteria for what constitutes a good screening test, it doesn't meet any of them. There are a lot of false positives. About 40% of children are sensitized, meaning they have an elevated IgE to milk, egg, shrimp, or peanut, but only 5% are allergic. So if we go by the testing alone, we're going to overdiagnose the vast majority of people. These tests are so bad that at our institution, we removed all of the blood food allergy panels because these panels are put together and widely marketed to general pediatricians and primary care physicians. And they say, wouldn't it be great to test your patient with one drop of blood and tell them everything they're allergic to? But they combine like random foods that make no sense whatsoever. They're testing people for rice and hops and barley and crazy things. So there's no clinical indication to ever order some random panel of food allergy tests because you get a lot of unnecessary, falsely positive results that don't mean anything clinically, and it causes a lot of harm. And one last thing I'll say about that is when I say harm, we now know it is without a doubt that if you tell somebody to avoid a food and they're not allergic to it, it absolutely causes harm in numerous ways. One, it can lead to disordered eating because now they're focused on a diet and it really takes over their lifestyle and they're avoiding foods they don't have to avoid. Or more specifically, in younger infants, especially those with eczema, we want to get them to eat food and keep it in their diet consistently to prevent food allergies. You tell those babies to avoid those foods that they're sensitized to, that's how you actually create allergy and cause them to be allergic later in life.
Great points that I want to dive into a little bit further. So you mentioned making sure that the children are not avoiding foods unnecessarily. and how that plays a role in preventing allergies. Can you go into more detail about that? So one of the questions that came up a lot in my Instagram is, how do we prevent allergies? I know there's no simple answer to that, but you kind of got into it a little bit there. So can you go into more detail about that?
There's no single cause as to why some people develop food allergy and others don't. It's multifactorial. We know that there's a strong inheritance pattern of an allergic predisposition. So allergic parents have allergic children, but there's no gene that passes on a specific food allergen from a parent or a sibling to a younger sibling or a child or anything like that. So there are children that are sort of predetermined to be more likely to develop food allergies. 20 years ago, we said avoid, avoid, avoid. We said no milk till 1, no eggs till 2, no nuts or peanuts till 3, and pregnant and breastfeeding mothers avoid everything because you're going to cause your child to become allergic. Well, it turns out that was based upon just, you know, the prevailing thought at the time, which made sense, but no evidence to support it. We now have very good evidence that shows that the opposite is true. The earlier we introduce these foods to the gut by having kids eat them, ideally around 4 to 6 months of age or whenever they're eating other solid foods, they can chew and swallow and not choke on their food, and then keep it in their diet consistently, that is the best path towards trying to promote tolerance and prevent food allergy. It's not rubbing it on the skin. We don't want to do that because that can cause nonspecific rashes. It can even sensitize kids. We want to let them eat it and then keep it in their diet consistently. There's multiple benefits to this. Primarily, it can help actually prevent food allergy in those who are predestined to develop it.
Yep. So consistent exposure is what it sounds like. And this is something that I see with GI issues too. We see this with fiber. People who can't tolerate fiber, consistently exposing themselves to different types of fiber, more fiber helps them to better tolerate that. I want to go back to the testing for just a second. So you mentioned false positives, and I know we were going through that, and I thought in my head, I know some people don't know what that means. So false positive means that it will say that you have the allergy when you actually don't. And if you do a screening test with 95 allergens or 100 allergens or whatever amount of allergens are included in the test, you're going to have some false positives and you're going to be removing foods that you don't need to remove. So that's just statistically speaking, there are going to be foods in a test if you do a large screening test where you're going to be removing foods that are not, you don't need to be removing because you're not actually allergic to them. I want to go off of testing a little bit because this is another very, very common thing. And we kind of addressed it already with the sensitivities, but food sensitivity testing. So the IgG testing, the MCAT testing, the ALCAT testing, all of these various types of food sensitivity tests. Can you speak to why those may or may not be something that people want to seek out?
Yeah, there's a couple of very easy explanations for why these tests are not useful. One is they're not validated, and that's really important. So the diagnostic tests that we do, we need them to be validated, which means we can trust them. And that means a couple of things. One, it means if you take the same person with the condition and you give them that test repeatedly over and over again, are they going to get the same results within themselves? Number two, do you take somebody who has a specific medical condition and somebody who does not, give them both the same test? Are you going to see very different results, saying that one person does have a condition and the other person does not? And then number three, has it been clearly established that a test result, you know, establishes a diagnosis? So all of these food sensitivity tests have not passed any three of those very basic steps for validation. So they're not valid. They're not validated tests. And it also means there's actually really no evidence that has been demonstrated that they establish a diagnosis in anybody. You can find research and you can pretty much find, you know, publications to support any stance these days because of all the open access journals and the millions of articles that are published every year. It doesn't mean it's high quality science. And if you really look through the research studies that are quoted on some of these websites and the marketing tools and things like that, it doesn't actually hold up to the test. So it's either very, very small sample sizes. It's using these tests in somebody where they lack a control group. So you're actually not seeing if there's any benefit in a group that, you know, didn't have the testing done, or it's for really specific indications, like for people with irritable bowel syndrome or migraines or something like that. So they've never been established to be good screening tests. One last thing that I'll say, the very well-validated IgE food allergy tests that we use and rely upon all the time are not screening tests. So there is no reason to believe that the unvalidated IgG blood tests, MCAT tests, you know, immediately release tests or leap testing, whatever it is, those aren't validated. Those are not screening tests either.
Exactly. And as you mentioned, I'm very familiar with that research with the IgG testing and the IBS and the migraines, and they're very small sample sizes. And they're having people, when you take an IgG test, you're going to see a lot of the common foods that you eat show up. So if you actually took an IgG test and you removed a lot of those foods, you're just removing a lot of the common foods that you ate. And chances are, if you're experiencing consistent digestive issues, you might feel better. That doesn't mean that the test was actually telling you anything. It was just chance. And in my own personal experience, because I've worked with lots of people with GI issues, I've seen 55 or more of these tests that have come from other practitioners before people reached out to me, and it never adds up. And you know, they remove the foods and then they're scared of eating these foods, and as you mentioned, some of the anxiety and disordered relationships with foods can occur as a result of these tests, and it's just not getting people to the right place. So I'm glad that you discussed that. So next I want to discuss, how do we treat food allergy? So if you do have a food allergy, and most of these are occurring in children, what do we need to do to go about treatment? Is there any treatment that can help to improve tolerance? Can you go into detail about that?
Yeah, the gold standard and standard of care remains identifying what you're allergic to and preventing accidental ingestion. So that's the mainstay of treatment, regardless of desensitization, which we'll talk about and things like that. And what that entails is making sure we have the proper diagnosis, helping people understand risk. So if you have an IgE-mediated food allergy, your main risk comes from eating the food. And we understand a lot more about individual thresholds. So it used to be, you know, there's a lot of fear-based messaging surrounding all of this stuff. But there were campaigns in the past that said even trace amounts can kill you, and just really scary stuff for people to read. That's not true. You know, for instance, we know, you know, that about 50% of people with peanut allergy need to eat almost, you know, 2/3 of one peanut kernel before they have any symptoms at all, let alone a severe reaction. So each individual varies in regards to their risk for reaction and severity and things like that. We help people understand the importance of reading labels to prevent accidental ingestion and communicating with food handlers when they go to restaurants and things like that. So that's really the mainstay for everybody. Also recognizing an allergic reaction.
Okay.
There is no known cure for food allergies. I know people listening right now will have read something on social media or online that somebody, you know, this is all snake oil. You know, there's miracle cures that are promised for every chronic condition known to mankind, and very few of any of them actually pan out. So it's really important that people understand that it can be very dangerous if somebody says that they can cure your food allergy, and they tell you to go ahead and eat whatever you're actually allergic to, because not only they're not going to cure it, they could cause a severe reaction. And we've had some tragic stories, even in our practice, you know, here in my hospital. So we do have ways now where we can actually reset the immune system to some degree and desensitize. So we've been doing desensitization for allergies for over 100 years. I say we, not me personally, of course, but you know, in the field. So this is what allergy shots do. So if you take somebody with environmental allergies to, you know, things like grass pollen or cat dander, we can actually give very, very small amounts of what they're allergic to and inject it into their body. Over time, it can actually help promote tolerance and decrease their symptoms. These are all long-term treatment options. When it comes to food desensitization, the most common way that we do this is through oral immunotherapy, which is intentional daily ingestion of very, very small amounts of that food allergen under very close supervision. There's a lot of math involved to make sure we're getting the right amount of protein. We gradually build up the amount that each person is getting over time until they reach a maintenance dose. As of right now, this is supposed to be years long, if not lifelong therapy, and it really needs to be given every single day. Now, what's the trade-off? This is a part of your daily life. So you have to be monitored for an allergic reaction. We recommend no intense exercise for about 2 hours after each dose. You have to take every dose on a full stomach. And then side effects can occur. Most people experience some form of allergic reaction because they're eating what they're allergic to. Hopefully these are mild symptoms such as hives or upset stomach, but anaphylaxis can occur. So there's a lot of onboarding involved. Now, what's the benefit of doing it? Well, over time, especially when you reach maintenance dosing, you can increase the threshold you need to eat to cause a severe allergic reaction. So whatever your milligram of protein is for maintenance dosing, say it's, you know, 3 peanuts, you're hopefully protected from accidentally eating up to, you know, 9 or 12 peanuts. Mm-hmm. Some people can start putting that food in their diet while they continue to receive maintenance dosing, but not everybody can. And some people do need to drop out because they're having significant adverse effects, or basically people just stop, you know, eating their food on a daily basis, especially in adolescence. They just get tired of taking it every day. So there's a lot that goes into that, but that's something that's been used in clinical practice for over a decade, and we're doing it more and more for other foods. There's similar research that looks at sublingual immunotherapy, so drops of the liquid allergen under the tongue, less risk for adverse effects. I can receive the similar benefit. That's not as widespread because it needs to be more standardized, and we need to have some better protocols in place, better understand that. There's a company that's working on a patch where you can desensitize to peanut by wearing microdoses on the skin. The evidence looks pretty good. It's not currently FDA approved because they need to make the patch a little bit stickier, but that's coming down the pike. And then what's really promising is we have these injections that will hopefully be available in the next year or so, maybe sooner, that block the IgE antibodies. So these are biologics. One's called omalizumab. We've used it for over 20 years for allergic asthma, has indications for people with chronic rhinosinusitis and nasal polyps, chronic hives, and they're investigating this for food allergy, and it looks promising so far, where it may offer that same level of protection if you accidentally eat what you're allergic to. Again, doesn't cure your allergy. If you stop any of these treatments, you revert back to being allergic, but hopefully the FDA will approve one of these biologics in the next year. So very promising times in regards to treatment.
Yeah. Interesting times overall with the technology and the advances in medicine. Really looking forward to what's happening over the next 10, 20 years with that. So another thing that I want to discuss is why do some people grow out of their allergies? Like, I know most people don't carry their allergies into adulthood. Why does that happen in some people? Why doesn't it happen in others? Can we go into a little detail about that?
Yeah, why? If you keep asking me why, you're going to be a headache. So why is a great question. We don't fully understand why, but we do know that it does happen. It more likely, so we know this about asthma. So just because somebody has asthma, you can take 1,000 people with asthma, which means they have at baseline some level of inflammation in their lungs and their airways get really twitchy and they have spasm. But that doesn't mean they all have the same type of asthma. I think it's the same with food allergy. So just because, you know, you take 10 people with milk allergy, they don't all have the same milk allergy. We know that, you know, 3/4 of them can actually tolerate it when you heat it in the oven. Same thing with egg, whereas others cannot. Some of them will have more severe milk allergies. Some of them may outgrow this, whereas others may have lifelong allergies. So we don't know why. It's probably, we use the word phenotypes. So there's something different about their immune system and their pathology that makes them a little different from somebody else with a different phenotype. So we know for children who have milk, egg, wheat, or soy allergy, about 85% of them outgrow it, usually by school age. So it's always important when you're diagnosed at a young age to have follow-up testing, typically once a year, to help identify when those kids may outgrow it, which is in contrast to those with peanut, tree nut, or seafood allergy, where only about 20% outgrow that as they get older. But yeah, some people do and some people don't. And then for those that we feel may have more persistent or potentially lifelong allergies, that's when we talk more about long-term treatment options and things like that.
Okay. And you mentioned that most people outgrow them. And so what are the recommendations for retesting? That's something that I think doesn't happen enough from my experience, is people get diagnosed really early and they don't necessarily retest to make sure that they're still allergic.
I agree. It breaks my heart. I see people that, you know, came in 5 years ago and they haven't come back. And lo and behold, they probably lost their allergy several years ago, but they continue to avoid it. So we generally repeat testing about once every 12 months, sometimes a little sooner. Sometimes we prolong things. But we definitely want to do that, especially in the first, you know, 5 to 10 years of life, because things can change dramatically with the immune system. And it really is heartbreaking when people continue to avoid foods that they're no longer allergic to.
Okay. Can we speak a little bit more about FPIs? Because I had a few questions about that, and I know that's a little bit not exactly like a true food allergy, but it's also related.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. And it's interesting to me. So FPIs is pretty darn rare. And yet when you go on social media, it makes it seem like every child has it. And I'll explain why in a second. And it scares the heck out of everybody. But for me, it's actually relatively easy to manage and handle. So food protein-induced enterocolitis syndrome, which is why we use the acronym FPIs. It's a mouthful. It is a food allergy because it's the immune system, but it's not that immediate antibody IgE. It's more of a T-cell mediated delayed onset allergy. So it's reproducible every time you eat the food. It typically presents in infancy, often before 12 months of age. And typically it's going to be to things that are not traditionally causes of IgE food allergy. So we can see this to things like rice and oat and sometimes poultry or yellow vegetables and things like that. But it can occur with cow's milk and egg, and it can pretty much occur with any food. Here's the story. The story is you feed something to your baby and they're completely fine. 2 to 3 hours later, they have profuse, like exorcist type vomiting, where they just puke their guts out. Sometimes it's followed by diarrhea, and then they get pretty lethargic. They're just wiped out after this. There are no associated hives. There's no associated swelling. This is not IgE mediated. This is very delayed onset. The downside is we don't have a good diagnostic test that says, yes, this is definitely FPIES. For somebody like me, all I do is see, you know, children with food allergies, so I have a higher index of suspicion, but this can often go undiagnosed for months to years at a time. Mm-hmm. It's almost impossible to diagnose after one episode of vomiting, and the reason is because there are a dozen reasons why kids vomit, typically from gastroenteritis. There's a lot of coincidence that can occur, but when we start hearing that story of, you know, two or three or four times they ate a food and they were completely fine, 3 hours later they start vomiting like crazy, that's when we start thinking that this could be FPIES. FPIES tends to resolve usually by 2 or 3 years of age. Similar rules apply. We typically reevaluate in about a year. And then the only thing we can really do is re-challenge. So sometimes we do that at home, depending upon the situation. Oftentimes we'll do that in the office setting where we actually just feed the food again. Because as it gets better, either they can no longer have the symptoms or symptoms tend to get more mild. And then one thing that we use to counteract this is I prescribe every single family something called Zofran, which is an anti-nausea medicine that dissolves in the mouth. So if their child does experience additional episodes of vomiting, we can give them some Zofran and make them feel better. But epinephrine doesn't treat it. Antihistamines doesn't treat it. Steroids don't treat it. It's an interesting diagnosis, but one that I love helping families clarify and help them navigate it.
Yeah, these things are so complicated and interesting. It's good to have an expert to learn more about these things. So another thing that I want to discuss, histamine intolerance. This is something that comes up, again, on social media a lot. I hear about it a lot. You know, low histamine diets have become popular in some circles. Is there any truth to people being sensitive to histamine, needing low histamine diets? Is that something related to this topic?
I'd love to pick your brain on this as well. I have not seen very good evidence that says that this is, you know, affecting as many people as are led to believe. So, you know, there are foods that contain all kinds of different chemicals. I always go back to, what's the diagnosis? What is the actual, is it just you're completely fine and then you eat a food that has high histamine content, then you have symptoms? It's unlikely. There's a lot of people out there that have, you know, chronic urticaria, chronic hives, non-allergic hives, they just tend to get hives for no good reason, which can be brought on by stress or temperature fluctuations or maybe the food that they're eating. Do you have migraines? We know that there are certain foods that can absolutely trigger migraines, not because you're allergic to them or the histamine content or anything like that. Or do you have mast cell activation syndrome or mast cell disorders? If that's the case, then yes, it can be diet related, but that's not technically the food necessarily, as it is your own body and what's going on inside your body with those mast cells and allergy cells. So it's really complicated, but you know, the hard problem that I have with this, Adrian, I assume you agree with this, is you make these blanket statements for just anybody who happens to come across a social media post. And, you know, Joe Schmo walks by and reads it and says, oh, maybe I should take a low histamine diet because I, you know, had poor night's sleep 3 nights ago or something like that. That's where it gets into big time problem areas. And a lot of people are adopting strict elimination diets when they don't have to.
I fully agree there. I've seen many people on low histamine diets, never seen anyone benefit from it. I've worked with one person who I felt like truly may have a reaction to histamine based on multiple challenges where he seemed to higher histamine foods really seemed to cause, you know, an allergic type of response. He was getting skin redness and that type of thing. But that was only one case. And I've worked with many, many people who have followed low histamine diets who have gone into this rabbit hole and thought that it was something that was affecting them, and it really wasn't. It was something else in the diet, you know, the wine, the actual alcohol, not the histamines, was affecting them. You know, there's usually more obvious low hanging fruit, and when you get on social media, everyone wants to talk to you about the secret magical solution that the doctors don't want you to know about, and oftentimes it's usually exercise habits, basic nutrition habits, sleep, stress management. It's usually not that complicated.
Or the stuff people overlook, like glycemic index, right? So there are foods that can spike your insulin and glucose, and then you come crashing down and you feel, you know, extreme fatigue after eating it. You know better than anybody the powerful nocebo and placebo effects when you follow these elimination diets or start taking supplements and stuff like that. So instead of sort of, you know, demonizing entire categories of food, I really want to be thoughtful about, well, what's your diagnosis and what's going on with you, and then think through how you'd benefit.
Exactly. So another thing I want to, and you alluded to it a second ago, what's the relationship between food allergies and like skin conditions like eczema? Is there a relationship? Are foods driving some of these skin reactions?
Yeah, it's a really complicated relationship. So we know that, you know, with eczema, for example, it is a chronic skin condition which has a very complex pathology. So there's immune system involvement, the skin barrier is often defective, there's mutations in the epidermis that allow water moisture and things like that. Infants with persistent eczema are predisposed to develop food and environmental allergies as they get older. It's very unusual for a food to be the sole cause of eczema. I know a lot of people on the internet, you know, have said that I eliminated milk or whatever and my child's eczema went away. Well, that's typically not the only piece of the story. All of the current and forthcoming clinical guidelines surrounding eczema all support the same thing. Don't do food allergy testing unless the history is very concrete that a food is causing rapid onset hives or swelling or things like that, because you're going to find a lot of kids who are sensitized. And if you take food out of their diet, they're the ones you're actually going to cause them to be allergic. And then number two, if you jump right to the foods, you're going to miss, you know, the vast majority of infants will just get better if you focus on good skincare and all the environmental triggers that can worsen eczema. So that's really problematic. And it's going to take years to kind of undo all of those old outdated approaches.
Okay, so food can play a role, but it's usually not the primary factor, and it shouldn't be the first thing that people focus on. Because I've worked with a lot of parents of children with eczema, and they come to me because they think nutrition is the primary thing, and typically I will refer them to focusing on, like you said, skincare and other factors first before they start taking food out of a kid's diet, because that's really challenging to put a child on like a more restrictive diet where you're taking out gluten and dairy and soy, and you're starting them off on that path. And as you've mentioned, when you take those foods away, then they can become more sensitized to them and can potentially become more allergic to those foods if you're not exposing them to them and you're taking them away for reasons that aren't, you know, that aren't a good reason.
Yeah, absolutely. We have so many great ways to for skincare. So many amazing, just good, you know, daily skincare regimens, as well as great medications. Tons of new medications that treat the inflammation that aren't steroid based. And so, before we think about foods, those children really kind of have to earn it. So, meaning you're following a very good skincare regimen. You're doing, you know, lots of moisturizers. You're avoiding fragrance products and scented products on the skin. You're using good anti-inflammatory medication. And then those you know, very rare infants that truly still have severe refractory disease despite all that, that's when we start thinking that maybe there's something else going on here. But for the vast majority, if we can apply these things, they're going to get better. And their eczema tends to get better as they get older anyway. So we can avoid potentially a lifetime of food avoidance. And this really, it's heartbreaking. I see these families that come with these panel tests. Everything's elevated. They were scared out of their minds to introduce these foods to their infants. We did miss this window of opportunity during infancy where we could have got the food in their diet to prevent food allergy. Now they're stuck with it. Now they're stuck avoiding, you know, 8 to 10 foods for years and years and years where we could have prevented that just by not doing the testing and focusing on giving the right education to these families up front.
Yep. One of the main things that I do when people come to me with children in these conditions is I'm telling them that they should be eating these foods. I'm like, we need to try to introduce as much as we can back into the diet as quickly as possible. And if there are reactions, then you can back off of those foods. But just removing foods based on these panels is just, it's so problematic. And I've seen it over and over again. Next thing I want to discuss is the rates of food allergies. Are they increasing? Because I've seen statistics saying that they're increasing. Are they really?
It appears to be for multiple reasons. You know, it's really hard to truly study prevalence of food allergy because you have to do these, you know, food challenges to prove that they're allergic. So a lot of these are based upon symptoms or self-report or these markers such as sensitization with blood testing or things like that. Mm-hmm. So it's really hard to capture exactly how many people have food allergies. It's probably 5 to 8% of the general population of both kids and adults. And it does seem to be increasing over time. We also know that food allergies disproportionately affect people from different racial backgrounds, from different socioeconomic backgrounds, different parts of the world, whether that's related to, you know, how far you live from the equator and amount of vitamin D you get versus just ancestry and genetic predisposition is yet to be teased out. But yeah, we definitely see differences in different populations as well.
And is I've seen you discuss this before, but one of the things that, and I've seen this in the literature as well, is the hygiene hypothesis and how that might be related. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, the theory is that for people who are born into farming environments and they're exposed to lots of animals from an early age, and most importantly, lots of bacteria and endotoxin, and their immune system is being challenged all the time, that they are less likely to develop allergies. So we don't see a lot of food allergies and other allergies in third world countries. Whereas we do see it more in highly civilized countries, because as we move to more cleaner environments where our people are protected from exposing their immune system to all these different bacteria and things like that, the way I think about it is their immune system kind of gets bored. So, I mean, it makes no evolutionary advantage for us to experience an allergic reaction to peanuts or ragweed or dog dander. So the IgE antibody initially evolved to help fight off parasitic infections. And as humans move to cleaner environments, we don't have to fight off parasites anymore, especially in the United States of America or other civilized nations. So the IgE gets bored and it starts reacting to all these antigens that really should not be problematic for human beings. So that's sort of the theory behind that. There's other cool research to support this. So they looked at Amish populations and they demonstrated lower rates of allergy and things like that. And then there's a great study from years ago where they took cohorts of infants at higher risk to develop allergy. And the way that their pacifier was cleaned by their parents was showed differences in their risk of developing allergy. So one group of parents, when the Binky fell out of their kid's mouth, they put it in their own mouth and then popped it back in their child's mouth. And the other group gave them a clean Binky or washed it off meticulously. So the ones where they used their own mouth to kind of wash it off and pop it back in had lower rates of allergy as they got older. So, you know, this movement towards being so hyper clean and sanitizing everything is probably doing a disservice to our immune systems over time.
I love that discussion because it's so counterintuitive, but I've looked into that literature as well. And it's one of the strongest signals that we see with preventing allergies is really the hygiene factor. And I've seen this with multiple points of data, as you mentioned, like the Binky. I've seen with families who use dishwashers because it sanitizes the plates better. There's multiple points of data that just continue to point to, if you're overly hygienic and you're using antibacterial products on everything, that's actually probably going to be negative in terms of building up your immune system and helping to prevent allergies. So let your kids play in the dirt, let them get dirty, let them pick food up off the floor and all of these different things, because that's going to help build up their immune system. And also there's some emerging evidence showing that helps with like the diversity of the microbiome, which can also probably play a role with the immune system as well, which is a really complicated topic that, you know, the research is emerging on as we speak.
Yes, I agree. Emerging. So be wary of anybody who says they figured out the whole microbiome thing. We're not quite there just yet. Yes, differences are absolutely, they do occur and they have been identified, especially for those who have allergies, for those who don't. But I think we're a little ways away from identifying that properly and knowing exactly what to do about it. So yeah, we don't need to get into that, but I agree.
Yeah, no, that's a very complicated discussion. I'm really excited about what the future holds for the microbiome though, because as we continue to understand it better, I feel like there's major implications for inflammatory and immune conditions when we really understand how to test the microbiome properly and modify it in such a way that it actually starts to support our health, when sometimes it can actually play a negative role.
Yeah, and if I may, I don't want to divert too much, but it is related to what we're talking about. So I think people, especially today and with social media, where everybody wants their information immediately. People aren't taking the time to digest information and figure out how it fits in with all the other information we know about how the world works. And we want to form instant opinions. Well, when it comes to understanding human health and all these chronic conditions, the evidence evolves over time and often changes over time. Sometimes it even contradicts itself. Like we now, with food allergy prevention, as we talked about, we used to say avoid, now we know eat. So if you just take a snapshot, or if you just take one study or one headline, that's not giving you the full picture. And I think there's a lot of folks out there, especially influencers online, that take these things and run with it. And they make these broad claims, overarching claims that aren't supported by the entire body of evidence. So it behooves all of us to take a deep breath, digest it all, take a step back and say, all right, how does all of this mountain of evidence sort of help formulate our opinions and understanding of things? And how has that changed over time? So for what it's worth, I think, you know, as we talk about all of these things, let's just take a deep breath and there's no one study that proves anything wrong or right.
Definitely. And as you mentioned, like you hear this, and I hear this frustration a lot, is a lot of consumers will say, well, the science is always changing. If you feel that way, you're probably getting your information from some of the wrong people, because the science changes very, very slowly. And what we know about nutrition, what we know about immunology, it's pretty well established. And there may be some changes over time. As you mentioned, over 20 years, we've kind of developed research to change the understanding of things. But you shouldn't be thinking like every few weeks that the science is changing, because that's not reality. That's headlines, because the New York Times will promote a headline one week that says low carb diets are the best, and then 3 weeks later will promote a similar headline saying that vegan diets are the best. And that's why many consumers are confused, is because you're not getting your information from evidence-based sources oftentimes, and you're getting your information from people who are trying to sensationalize this topic, as opposed to people who care about your health, I would say, because that's the reality. Like, as a healthcare provider, it's very clear that the information that you're providing is, you are doing it from a place of, I want people to know what's correct, and I want people to be able to benefit from it. And that's not always the case. And most of the information, typically, like if you go Google food allergy, you're going to get a lot of ads from companies who have a financial stake in getting you to believe something. And unfortunately, that you have to be extremely skeptical of all of the information that you come across, because most of the people that you're going to, when you seek information, most of the first sources that you come into contact with are going to be people who have a financial stake in getting you to believe a certain thing. And one of the most profitable things to get people to believe in this space is food allergy screening, food sensitivity screening. So you'll see ad after ad after ad getting you to buy into these things, because if they can spend $50 to get that ad in front of you and you spend $200 on the test, that company continues to grow and they can blast that information out to everyone. And so, unfortunately, that's how it works. We don't, because we're not selling a $200 test on this podcast, we can't run ads to get it to every single person. And so that's unfortunately where the balance of accurate information and information that is supporting an interest, sometimes it's harder to find accurate information, and the information that is very biased and trying to get you to believe a certain thing is usually put in front of you very, very easily.
Yeah, very well said. And you know, for all of your listeners, you and I, we know the playbook, right? We could flip this around and we could make ourselves very famous and very lucrative, because we know how to manipulate the science, but we choose not to. Instead, we're beating our heads against the wall, fighting all the misinformation that comes at us nonstop, left and right. But we're having this conversation because we really want to help people. We want to help those who actually have these conditions and need to seek evaluation and get the guidance they need. But we want to help those who don't have these conditions understand why maybe, you know, going down these elimination diets isn't the right path for them, and that it's still helpful to talk to their own doctor about their concerns and go from there. So I'm sure all of your listeners appreciate that. That's why they listen to you and follow you. But, you know, this is great. This is why I love, you know, interacting with folks like you, and we can have this conversation, try to help as many people as we can.
I really appreciate it. And I had a few more questions, but I don't want to continue and take too much of your time, because I know we can go off on tangents about these questions as well. So I'm just going to direct my listeners to go follow you, because I know you have lots of content out there. You're putting out information on social media. You have your podcast. Is there anything else that you want to direct people towards in terms of good sources for information on this topic?
Yeah, I always highlight the professional organizations. You mentioned I'm involved in several of them, but they're led by the true experts in different fields, whether it's gastroenterology or nutrition or allergy and immunology. There's two great allergy organizations in the United States, the American Academy and the American College of Allergy, Asthma, Immunology. There's great organizations in Canada and Europe as well. So go to them. They all have social media presences and great websites filled with information. And if you're up for it, I'd love to come back sometime and we can, you know, hit some other highlights that we missed today. But this was great talking with you.
Definitely. I'd love to have you back on. I've discussed this in the podcast before. I am very selective in the people that I bring on, and the people that I do bring on are the experts of experts. So I'm only going to, if we talk about food allergies or food intolerances again, I will definitely be reaching back out to you, because I want to make sure that I connect my audience to the people that are providing the right information and also who care, because that's also important, because I know that it's really easy to have a podcast. And as you mentioned, the playbook in podcasting is typically bring a lot of popular people on, feature, you know, very sensational messages, and that's how you grow a podcast. But my goal is not to do that. I want to connect people with experts who are going to provide the right information. And if you listen to the show, hopefully you continue to develop more knowledge around these various topics, and you feel more comfortable about nutrition, and you don't feel like you necessarily need to listen to the show or need to continue to seek out, you know, sources in this space. And you just feel like as we mentioned, it's not always changing. So you don't have to continue to find the new thing. My goal is not to sell you the new thing. My goal is to help you develop an understanding of these various topics. So I appreciate you coming on, Dr. Stukas. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us, and we definitely look forward to having you on again.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.